here today with our old friend Ben Heller, a frequent podcast guest and someone that both Mitu and I learn a lot from and often turn to for help. And I think we have a reasonably entertaining podcast topic today, at least I think so. We're talking about the deeply innovative, really interesting, super sophisticated, actually, I think maybe that's not the right introduction, but the completely lunatic, bizarre bond issued by Nayib Bukele, not personally, but by El Salvador, that has all kinds of funky features attached to it, and that was used in part to fund a debt buyback, all kinds of ridiculous things that we wanted to ask Ben about. But first, Ben, welcome. I have lots of questions, but
thanks for having
me. Nice to have you. Can you just give us the backstory or the introduction or the, if there's a core message that people who are interested in this bond should take away, would it be?
Yeah, well, listen, let me just say something at the outset by way of a caveat. So I'm going to have some critical things to say about the design of this El Salvador instrument and about the process of how it was brought to market. But I do want to make sure that it's not received as criticism of state contingent instruments, or a criticism of performance-linked bonds. In fact, we've done a lot of work on getting acceptance of so-called G-linked bonds, like ESG, but just the G part. And you know, performance-linked bonds, they do have a lot of power to align interests if the right performance benchmarks are chosen and like the scale of the economic incentive is set correctly. So this isn't a criticism of like that sort of approach to building your debt stock. It's really about this bond specifically, or this warrant specifically. And so let me give you the background. So El Salvador faces some maturities of their existing Eurobonds coming up. They don't, they haven't had market access up to now for years at this point. And with the rally in sort of lower quality emerging markets credits in the past couple of months, they were sort of in striking distance of being able to issue. But there's a lot of concern in the market about policy settings in the Bukele government and whether they're going to pursue an orthodox path and whether they might be able to get an IMF program. So they decided to do an exchange to try and take out some of their shorter dated debt that's coming due in 2025 and to issue a new bond to take that out and to kind of assuage people's concerns about policy settings in the Bukele government. They decided to attach to the bond a warrant. And that warrant pays basically nothing to start. But in 2025, it will start to measure compliance with performance criteria, and the payout will be based on that. And so it's binary. If they do not meet their performance criteria, it will pay 4% a year. And if they don't meet the performance, if they do make the performance criteria, it's basically nothing. It pays 0.25% a year. And the performance criteria, this is the interesting part. The performance criteria is they get an IMF program or their ratings are raised to B-. We've never seen a warrant that explicitly is linked to an IMF program or a bond that's linked specifically to an IMF program. There have been bonds in the past, not in the sovereign space, but in the corporate space where there are coupon fluctuations related to rating. But this is a very large difference, 0.25 to 4%. And the fact that it's linked to an IMF program is very unusual. So that is the background. It was issued. It came at a pretty high spread. There was not a lot of value attached to that warrant, at least at the outset. And there's some question about whether the exchange really made that much sense, because when you look at the cash flows before and after, they're not that different. So from that perspective as well, it's sort of a curious deal because it didn't actually address their liquidity problems in a particularly meaningful way.
Let me ask a follow-up if I can. Because something has been troubling me about this, and I have looked at it only superficially, but my early reaction was that the circumstances in which the and the warrant is triggered are also circumstances in which there's a pretty high probability of a debt default. And so maybe the warrant is triggered but not getting paid. And if that's true, this is kind of like a bond that just, yes, the warrant can be traded separately, but it's kind of like a bond that just has a high penalty default rate. And, you know, it starts looking like an instrument to dilute the rest of the debt in the event of a default and restructuring. Is that too simplistic or
no,
wrong
I think
way
that's
to think
the,
of
that's
it?
one of the main one of the big problems with it is that it's effectively El Salvador writing insurance on El Salvador behaving badly, right? So that's not who you'd want to buy insurance on El Salvador bad behavior from. And it's similar to kind of the situation we had with the Franz in Argentina, right? Where Argentina was writing insurance to bondholders on Argentina spreads widening. Now, in this case, there one mitigating factor is that this is a warrant attached to a single bond. The bond is under $1 billion outstanding. So you're talking about a $40 million a year payment if that warrant triggers. So it's not enough by itself to blow up El Salvador. That said, I don't think that the market necessarily is going to put a ton of value on an instrument that only kicks in, only starts paying you when El Salvador has been unable to reach an IMF program and continues to be rated below B-. So the sensitivity of that instrument to El Salvador's performance is kind of strange. Like that instrument may start to increase in price if El Salvador is doing, you know, isn't doing great. But if El Salvador starts doing poorly, then you don't believe that the instrument's even going to pay. So there's sort of a narrow window in which that instrument actually functions the way that it should in terms of insuring investors. So yes, that's a problem. And if an instrument like this were to be used more broadly and to be attached to more of the debt stock, then you have a situation where it really will push a country having trouble getting an IMF program could be pushed into default. In this case, since they've only issued it with one, that's not really a problem. I think what the Salvadorans would say, or really what the underwriter or the designer of this bond would say is, well, it's not so much to insure bondholders against El Salvador behaving badly, but it's a signaling device to show that El Salvador is extremely serious about getting an IMF program. Because I think one of the specific strange things about El Salvador is that they've fought with the IMF about some fairly peculiar, they've had some peculiar disagreements with the IMF. And first among them, this question of whether Bitcoin is going to be legal tender in El Salvador or not. So people look at this as, this is bizarre. I don't really understand how El Salvador thinks about this stuff. I don't understand why they would let a strange idea like Bitcoin is legal tender get in the way of an IMF program. And so people aren't sure whether they're in earnest about pursuing that program. So by putting this warrant out there, I think the idea was to put a stake in the ground. We El Salvador, we are really serious about getting an IMF program. Now, the question of how the IMF feels about that is another one, and that's, I think, a really fascinating aspect of this that we need to talk about before the podcast is over. But hopefully that answers your question.
Oh, can we please go directly to how the IMF feels about it? And then afterwards, Ben, I also want to ask you about your feelings about this. I know you have these two creatures in your head, at least, that are always operating. There's Ben, the finance professor / law professor who reads the document and thinks about macro factors. And then there's Ben, the investor. And, you know, you were one of those who, I think, very early recognized in the Franz that these were kind of lunacy, but you bought them because you recognized, you know, from an investment perspective, this is kind of very good for me, very bad for country.
Yeah, there's an opportunity to make money off it. Why don't I can start with that, and then we can talk about the IMF. So I think, you know, we looked at this and we said, okay, well, this is interesting because we think maybe people are going to be so confused by this warrant restricted by their mandate from holding this sort of warrant, because the warrant detaches from the bond. It's not going in any index, that maybe we'll be able to get it on, at a very cheap level because there's just forced sellers. And for a brief moment, it was pretty cheap. I mean, it was priced as though there was almost 100% probability that El Salvador would get the IMF program or meet the ratings criterion. And we felt like, hey, listen, if they don't, it's not a lock that they default, particularly if it's a question of delay. Now, they did set the deadline for having the IMF program fairly deep into 2025. So not having an IMF program by 2025, that is perhaps a more dire sign than not having the IMF program, say, you know, by the end of 2024. But even a failure to do it by 2025 is not a guarantee that El Salvador is going to be in default. So we said, listen, if it prices, if you could get this where it prices, you know, it's a 50-50 shot that they get the IMF program right at 2025. And if they don't, they probably can pay you one or two coupons. We could price it that, if we could get it at priced on that basis, it would be an interesting instrument. And in addition, and this is something we can go into in more detail because it implicates the question of people reading indentures, right? Was what happens, what's your claim on this instrument in default? And after a lot of digging and kind of back and forth with the underwriter, we found that it had a fairly favorable claim in default, in that if there's a default, if El Salvador defaults on the underlying bond, right, on the vanilla bond that's attached to this, then this warrant is assumed to pay 4%, you know, pay the high coupon all the way to maturity. And your claim is instant, discounted, it's that stream of 4% discounted back at the issuance price of the bond, which was 9.25%. So suddenly, if they default, suddenly this instrument, you're going to have, you know, a claim of, I can't remember the number exactly, it was 10 or 11 or 12. So, you know, in a world where recoveries might be, you know, 40, 50, 60%, well, I have a claim of 10 or 11 in default. So this thing actually will have could have a reasonable recovery in default because of the way that they calculate your claim in case of default.
Is it, so I'm sorry, I do want to follow up on this, even though I think I'm re-asking the question that I asked before. Surely, if I'm sitting at the fund and I've expressed publicly my distaste for debt dilution, this instrument seems to me like one that's designed to dilute other creditors in the event of a default. Yes, it's not. There are non-default scenarios where the warrants have a payment triggered, but basically, it's not that different from saying, "All right, I'll pay you 12, but if I default, you get a bazillion, and you can give me a, you can express a claim for accrued interest in a restructuring that's going to be some multiple of the bond's face value."
That's a dynamic, except that the scale is a scale that is very different than the scale of the FRAN, because at worst, this is 4% until 2029, right? So it's not going to, and it's only on one bond. But like I say, if this were scaled differently, and if this becomes a pattern, and they attach this to bonds that they issue in the future, then it could come with a magnitude where it does function the way that you say. I think this is a good segue into how does the IMF feel about it? And I need to give you a little context about this, because my firm, we've been advocates of the idea of governance linked bonds. So this is like ESG, but just the G part. And that that in restructurings, we would like to see bonds where there are meaningful performance criteria attached to those bonds, performance criteria that relate to creditworthiness, but they're things within the government's control, like, and things related to transparency and anti-corruption action. So we'd say, okay, listen, we're going to make a list of criteria, like you have to publish all of your procurement information, like you need to disclose all debt that might have confidentiality clauses that wouldn't allow you to actually share all the terms of the debt, things like that. And if you if the country hits all of those targets, then the coupon might go down by 15 or 20 basis points. So not a large variation, but enough that it's an incentive, and it forces the country to publish their conformance or lack of conformance with those criteria, and it hopefully creates an incentive for the country to do the right thing and aligns incentives with creditors. We'd like to see these countries be more transparent. We'd like to see them fight corruption harder. We'd like to see their governance be of higher quality. And, you know, that helps their citizens, that helps us. So we've been really strong advocates of that. As part of that, we had some conversations with folks in the policy area at the IMF, and we said, do you feel like this would be a constructive, would you view this constructively as an addition to the restructuring toolkit? And their answer was yes. And then our further question is, okay, well, are there metrics or performance criteria that are sort of, we should stay away from? Are there any red lines that you have? And one thing that they were very clear about is they said, we really don't love the idea of a bondholders adopting IMF performance criteria wholesale as their criteria for a governance-linked bond. And we particularly don't like it if it's criteria that the board signs off on as opposed to staff-level criteria. And I think the idea was that they don't want the board to be cross-pressured when, you know, the board is considering whether or not to sign off on programs or sign off on performance criteria. That, you know, oh, if we don't sign off on this, then suddenly we're imposing an extra cost on the country. They'd like to have complete independence of action. So I understand that. And there's certainly plenty of performance criteria that we could choose that are distinct from the ones that the IMF imposes itself. And they can be perfectly constructive criteria. So when this bond issue was announced, and they said it's linked literally to the board approving a program, right? Not a specific criteria. We said, that is crazy. Like, were we lied to, or are we being lied to? So, you know, we asked the underwriter, and the underwriter said, no, we spoke to the IMF. The IMF loves this idea. And I found that very hard to believe. And, you know, I was the IMF World Bank spring meetings took place last week, and I was in DC, and I had some further conversations about this. And the answer I got back from, you know, people IMF or IMF adjacent was, no, we do not. It was polite. They said, well, this is small, but we definitely do not want this to become a habit, right? We do not want to see more of these for the reasons I think that they explained to us in our prior conversations, right? They don't want the board to be cross-pressured. So, you know, we brought that back to the underwriter. And then the underwriter said, well, actually, you know, the IMF was informed but not consulted. So that was a bit of a climb down. And today, interestingly, there was a report in, you know, one of these subscription services, Red Intelligence, where, you know, they had an IMF source that said, we weren't consulted. We don't like this. We think this is a bad idea. And I think it's both what you're talking about as, you know, having an instrument that imposes a greater payment burden when the country is in, you know, is perhaps facing distress. Although in this case, again, the scale I think is makes it more benign. But also, I think that they really don't like the choice of performance criterion. They don't want to be in a situation. The IMF doesn't want to be in a situation. The board is trying to figure out whether to sign off on a deal or not. And they know that if they don't, that they've imposed this cost, this additional cost on the on the country, and perhaps given a windfall to bondholders.
So Ben, just to follow up on that, so in this, you probably know this since you're a student of the history of the sovereign debt markets, but Mark and I have done some work on events of default in sovereign bonds, and one of the events of default for emerging market countries in particular, although we found some of these in some of the Greek bonds as well, is that if you fail to be in good standing
with the IMF, if you're like kicked out, which has only happened to, you know, the only time that that provision that people paid a little bit of attention to that provision was in Venezuela, because Venezuela was in danger. You know, they hadn't done an Article 4 for however long. They're not really cooperating. You know, they haven't been cooperating with the IMF. And before they defaulted, there was there were certainly people who were speculating on the possibility that even while they were performing, they might no longer be a member in good standing of the IMF. And then the bonds were puttable at par. And at that time, the bonds, not all of them, but some of them had this term, that the bonds were trading below par. And people felt, oh, well, these bonds are trading at 70 or 75 or 80 at the time. I don't remember exactly. They won't be a member in good standing with the IMF. I'll be able to put these bonds to them at par and I'll make 25 points or whatever the gap was between where the bonds were trading and par. Of course, you know, like that was a, I don't want to say that was moonshine, but I'm not sure that had that happened, I'm not sure that the Venezuelans would have paid. They would have said, okay, listen, we're paying you according to the bond contract. Yes, it says that you can put these stuff at par, but that we're simply not going to honor that. What are you going to do? You want us to just not pay you at all? So I wasn't sure that was really a particularly promising trading strategy, but certainly people talked about it at the time.
Yeah, and I'm glad I did not know about that happening with Venezuela. I do remember hearing in the course of research on a different article with respect to Greece that some investors who had old Greek contracts with the good standing language or something equivalent, because the language that is used in all of these, some it's sort of eligible, some it's good standing, some have a different variation. With Greece, there were investors who tried to say, oh, the event of default has been triggered. And I don't know what happened, but I think at least some of them might have gotten a nice hefty payout in exchange for keeping very, very quiet about the possible event of default occurring. But the reason I wanted to ask about this is in the papers of Sir Joseph Gold, the first general counsel of the IMF, he thinks it is a terrible thing to allow countries to put in place these kinds of provisions for exactly the same reasons that you articulated as to why the IMF doesn't like Bukele's current bond strategy, because the IMF did not want to be on the hook for an event of default. But all of that's wind up to ask whether from an investor perspective, might this be a good thing? Because if I'm an investor, I do want the IMF to give them money more easily, because the IMF maybe doesn't want protests outside its office or people clamoring for IMF action. Or I mean, isn't it a way of sort of tying one's fate to IMF choices, and then you can always blame the IMF for being the bad guy and causing trouble in your country?
Well, sure. But that's why the IMF doesn't want it. And I think that in reality, it probably makes, I think the principle is more important to the IMF, and it makes it less likely that they'll get a program. Because I think you're right, the IMF doesn't want to be on the hook for, you know, inflicting these extra cash flows on a country, perhaps inflicting such large cash flows that they would have to default. But I think it's probably even more important to them to signal to every other borrower that their independence of action cannot be compromised. So maybe they choose not to give El Salvador a program because it would be perceived that they flexed because of the existence of this instrument. So I think it cuts both ways. I don't think it's an instrument that should help bondholders in a world where the IMF doesn't like it. I do think, however, I go back to what I said at the beginning, there is space for instruments that align incentives and that can generate some benefits for countries. And I prefer to view it as benefits in exchange for good behavior, right? That can provide some benefits, some cash flow relief in exchange for good behavior, because that good behavior is going to lead to better creditworthiness and lower spreads. That's going to help us. It's going to help investors' returns. The issue is you have to pick the right targets, and the magnitudes have to be such that you don't create a doom loop, right? That you don't create a situation where you ask them to do to perform, you know, to meet certain benchmarks, then they fail those benchmarks, and that causes them to default. So that's why when we've looked at these kinds of instruments, we say, you know, that it should be fairly small coupon adjustments. I think the way that you see in the world of ESG, you know, bonds and, you know, certain kinds of green bonds, that there are small coupon adjustments in exchange for hitting key performance indicators. They're just, you know, those work really well. It just can't be that the adjustment is so large that it can sink the country. And you can't pretend that that you can have a bond where the adjustment is large enough to offset the impact of bad behavior or deterioration creditworthiness. I mean, that was the Fran mistake. I mean, you simply cannot credibly insure, a country can't credibly insure its creditors against its own deterioration of creditworthiness. But giving a 25 basis point coupon relief in exchange for meeting a bunch of transparency indicators, I think that is a really great way to align interests.
So can we talk a little bit about the use of at least some of the proceeds from the issuance of this bond, and in particular the use to fund the kind of partial buyback of some of the short-dated bonds that were out there? And I guess I'm wondering what your take on the debt buybacks was. I don't have a super strong view, and I wouldn't call myself incredibly knowledgeable, but my, you know, my understanding is that buybacks are often, at least the economists I know, often don't think of them as a particularly effective debt management tool, especially when you're buying back only a small portion of the debt that's maturing. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out whether the use of proceeds for buybacks makes any sense in this context.
Well, I mean, you can do buybacks in two ways. Maybe you think about, sometimes buybacks are about liquidity management, and sometimes if we think back to the Brady era, they were about improving solvency and generating gains for the issuer. Like if you had some sort of complex or ugly bond that traded below its fair value, well, then the issuer could issue something vanilla and buy back this other bond cheap to fair, you know, somewhat cheap to fair value, and that was actually solvency enhancing, or at least provided net present value gains to the issuer. In this case, we're talking more about a liquidity management situation. And I think that, you know, El Salvador has a fairly large bond coming due in 2025. And taking some of that out, I think, does make sense. It reassures people that the challenge of meeting the maturities in 2025 will be lessened. Means that, you know, market access should be easier to achieve. And so that makes sense. And they were able to buy back those bonds, you know, below par at a reasonably good yield. So it was not like very expensive to do that. What was peculiar is that there was, they didn't just buy back the 25s. They also allowed people to choose to swap their 2027s and 2029s. And in that situation, well, those bonds aren't due for a long time. This bond has three amortizations. So it's, almost the same maturity as the bonds you're taking out. It wasn't at a lower spread. I mean, maybe the idea was with that warrant, the bond would come at a lower spread or something, but it didn't. So that seemed like you're just exchanging apples for apples, and didn't make a ton of sense to me.
Is it apples for apples, or is it you're taking cheaper apples and replacing them with
more expensive
really
apples?
Expensive.
No, I mean, the yields were pretty similar. The yields were pretty similar, but in reality, if that warrant triggers, then you are talking about a much higher coupon between now and maturity. So yes, I mean, it actually shifts some cash flows forward, because you are taking out bonds, I think, that had, you know, 6 3/8 and 8 5/8 coupons, and you're replacing it with a bond that essentially is costing you close to 12%, even if you hit the IMF, even if you hit those performance targets, and like 16 if you're not. So in that case, yeah, the cash flows between, say, in 2026, 27, 28, 29 would be higher with this new bond than with the old bonds. So that part of it, yeah, did not make a ton of sense to me. But the taking out the 2025s, I think there's some logic to that.
This seems completely like, I want to persuade Mark that we title our podcast Bukele's Boozy Bond or something like that. It just seems utterly nutso. But Ben, you mentioned getting the indenture very early in our
story.
So can I Mark and I have been obsessed with getting indentures, which we can never get.
It's hard, and we can't get them. We own bonds, and we can't get them. This is one of the most peculiar things about EM markets, that I could have owned a bond for years and years, and I have to beg for the indenture.
So how, like, I think that many of them say that you can't get the indenture unless you become an investor, at which point. Well, I already bought it, so what's the point of giving me the indenture now?
Right. Well, you can borrow it by a small amount, I guess. I think they should be freely available. I think this is a simple innovation that you know, we ought to, that in the next round of, you know, drafting standardized EM debt contracts, you know, having public access to the indenture for anybody ought to be one of the things that is guaranteed by contract. Because we have many instances, you know, there are many instances where the prospectus and the indenture don't match up, which is sloppiness, right? In an ideal world, the prospectus would be would give you a good account of what the indenture says. But often there are subtle and very specific narrow points that you have to get exactly right, and the prospectus doesn't capture what's in the indenture. So yes, that's a peculiar thing about the market. But I'll tell you, in this case, I can tell you what happened. So, you know, we were interested in the bond, if only for academic reasons. And, you know, we had someone attend the roadshow. And we said, listen, the warrant is a pretty, it's a novel instrument. And we have some questions specifically related to what happens if there's a default and what your claim is. And we really need to see the indenture to feel confident of how that works, to get to an answer that of which we're confident. And the response that we got was, well, the indenture's not ready. So they're having the roadshow, right? The indenture's not ready. So okay, well, you know, just how about just get it to us as soon as you can, you know, so that we can see it before we have to decide whether we're going to subscribe or not. And they said, well, unfortunately, the indenture's not going to be written. It won't be finished until after the bond is settled. That's an interesting idea, that we're all buying this bond and the contract isn't actually fully written yet. And as it turns out, the prospectus wasn't totally clear on what recovery, how your claim would work in default. And between the that meeting and when the bond was issued, they did put an addendum on the prospectus that went into more detail about how your claim would be determined. But ultimately, it's the indenture that governs. And just the very idea that an underwriter could nonchalantly say, oh, well, that indenture is not going to be done until after the bond is issued is pretty crazy. Now, for the underlying, for the vanilla bond, that indenture does already exist because it's issued on, the bond is being issued under a shelf. But for the warrant, which is a novel instrument, that's a new indenture. And honestly, everybody should be able to see that before they subscribe.
Okay, you have just given me a great exam question for my next contracts exam. And so, well, hopefully the students aren't going to be listening to this podcast, but this whether or not those contract terms are actually enforceable.
Right, are we bound? Are we bound? I often had that question, like, are we bound? We bought this thing before there was even a contract. What did we actually bind ourselves to? I don't know.
Well, especially if you've asked them for it and they give you this kind of doofusy answer, which yeah. Clearly they didn't run by their legal counsel, who would have
said, like, don't say no, that. Just don't even say, don't that. Say that. Yeah. Now, to be fair, they did send us the indenture. I mean, like, you know, not long after it settled, we got a copy of the indenture. And I think in this case, the indenture and the prospectus did match up pretty well. Whether that would have been the case had we not asked, I don't know. Maybe that would have been months later and it would have said something completely different than the prospectus. But we did ask in front of everybody. And to be fair, the underwriter, it was only a short time after the bond settlement.
Well, Ben, thank you so very, very much. This has been one of the most fun conversations, and we always have fun conversations with you. So thank you very much, and we hope we have you back again soon.
All right. Thanks for having me on.